Welcome to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders, hosted by Mike Tsakopoulos and produced by the American Association for Physician Leadership.
Like many of you, I was a caregiver for my father at the end of his life. What had started as minor indignities of age had progressed into obstacles to life. Years later, I remember the emotional cocktail of sadness, fear, and exhaustion that caregiving came to be. I needed a guide. My guest today has prepared just such a guide for the millions of our fellow Americans who are or will be caregivers. Next on Sound Practice. My guest today is Jennifer O'Brien. She is a healthcare expert and author. Ms. O'Brien's first book was the award-winning The Hospice Doctor's Widow. Her newest book is Care Boss, Leadership Strategies and Resources for Family Caregivers. Jennifer O'Brien, welcome to Sound Practice.
Why, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you, Mike.
And I really should say, welcome back to Sound Practice. You've been on before, and I've been looking forward to talking to you about your new book. Let's set the stage for our audience. How many of our fellow Americans are caregivers for a family member? And is this a growing demographic?
Yeah, right now the number we have is 53 million. If that's 53 million Americans taking care of an adult, 18 years or older. And by care, we mean anything from helping with doctor's appointments or paying bills to full on, you know, in the same household, kind of taking care of someone who is nearing end of life. So it's a really broad range. That 53 million number is from the AARP and the National Alliance for Caregiving. But that figure is 5 years old. They have a new report. They do a report every 5 years. This one is coming out. They've delayed it a couple times. They say it's at the end of July now is when it'll come out. And there is every indication that that number will shoot up. So at least 53 million.
and I assume that number tracks with demographically our population, as we have an aging population in the country, we would expect that more people need caregiving.
Absolutely.
Is that fair?
Absolutely. Yes. These are adults that need care for one reason or another. And most often it's that they're aging and ill, or, you know, one or the other or both.
So, and you somewhat anticipated my next question, but it occurs to me that caregiving is a pretty broad category. Some might consider giving a ride to an elderly relative, you know, to church on Sunday is caregiving, where others would have a more active definition in mind. For purposes of your book, what are your parameters for caregiving?
Yeah, I use, in the introduction of my book, I use the AARP NAC definition or question, which is at any time in the last 12 months, has anyone in your household provided unpaid care to a relative or friend 18 years or older to help them care for themselves? And they go on to specify this could be just about anything. And this person need not live with you. And as you heard in the question, it's relative or friend. So you don't need to be blood related to be considered what everyone refers to as a family caregiver. Family is a nicer way of saying uncompensated. Use that term instead. So, yeah.
Well, and I think we all probably have people in our life that we consider family that are not.
Exactly.
Would not meet maybe a strict legal definition of it, but we would consider them family.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Let's take a step back. I jumped in because I was excited to talk about your new book and this topic, but maybe we should start with, why did you write the book?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. So I had, as you know, Mike, I had allowed my art journal. My late husband was a hospice and palliative care physician. I had allowed my art journal that I kept while I was caring for him to be published as a book. It came out about 5 years ago. And that kind of launched me into the middle of the caregiving advocacy, end of life, grief space pretty quickly. And I discovered a young woman named Lucinda Koza, who at the time, she is no longer doing this, but at the time she was caring for her father, and she had amassed a following of about 100,000 family caregivers who were millennial and Gen Z. So these, and that is a significant percentage of the family caregiver population are young folks who are doing this very difficult work and sometimes putting their careers on hold to do it. So she had this huge following, and one day she posted on Instagram, "Remember, you are the CEO of the situation." Now, Mike, I have now done the very intense family caregiving for my mother, who died of pancreatic cancer, my husband, who died of renal clear cell carcinoma, and my father, who died of congestive heart failure and lung disease. And I thought to myself, wow, that's so true. And I've done the CEO position, right? For several, I do an interim CEOing thing for several large practices over the course of my career. That's kind of my niche. And I thought, wow, she is spot on this. You are the CEO of the situation. And yet most family caregivers have not been a CEO. And right. So I thought, well, that's only, you know, it's totally true, but I can help fill in some of those blanks for people as to what does that actually mean to be the CEO of the situation. And I'm fortunate also in that I've done this interim CEOing in the healthcare setting, right? Which is such a big part of family caregiving. So I started to think about it, and I started writing this book, trying to say, here's everything I know about leadership as it relates to family caregiving, and just giving family caregivers, you know, everything I could to help them see it as the leadership position that it is. It really is a leadership position. And I would contend that it, as someone who has done some decent sized leadership positions, I would contend it is a more significant leadership position than the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, right? Because we're taking care of our person, and this person means more than the world to us. And so it's big. It's really, really big. And seeing it through that leadership lens only helps us to, the heart is already there. What we need is some of the strategies and the resources and the perspective of a leader in order to be able to help our person in the best possible way, and to ultimately, you know, achieve mission and vision.
Well said. Jen, I occasionally help clients with creating wills or estate planning documents. I find very few of the folks that I work with anticipate future caregiving for themselves or for loved ones, even though we just talked about the enormous percentage of folks that have dealt with this or are dealing with it. Why is it? And what do you recommend people do to prepare for future caregiving needs of family members?
Well, I recommend that you start early before anybody gets sick, ideally. That's certainly what my husband and I did, and to some degree, my mom and my dad did it as well. You know, talking about what you want and you don't want as you get older and more sort of needing more and more assistance. I think that it's important to, at a certain age, whether that's when the kids move out or what, you start looking at your domicile and envisioning it as the facility, right? Such that Bob and I moved into a condo when he got sick because he knew I wouldn't do well in the house. And the shower had an enormous 6-inch by 6-inch by 6-inch curb. Mm. And getting him in and out when he got really sick was pretty darn difficult. So I recommend looking at things like that, looking at where you're living, where you will be living, where your parents are living, where they will be living, and start on that stuff sooner rather than later and have those conversations and do the work, because it is so difficult. You know, 80% of us will die of illness or old age. Only 20% of us will die suddenly. And it's easy to sort of, well, I don't know, I might get hit by a bus tomorrow. You know, it's easy to sort of throw that out there as a reason not to worry about the three steps up into the house and the fact that your mom might not be able to negotiate those very soon. But that's, you know, that's no answer. And especially your listeners of all people, right? Physician leadership. I mean, we know this in our work, we know this in our lives, and it's time to go ahead and apply it to our own families. And if I may go so far as to say, you know, create an environment where our employees are starting to think about it and being able to discuss it in their own families.
Do the needs of a caregiver vary depending upon whom they're providing care to? For example, do caregivers for a child or a spouse have different needs than caregivers for elderly parents, for example? And I'm not talking about the person that they are caring for. I'm talking about themselves, their needs. Does it vary depending upon their interaction with whom they're providing care?
That is a good question, Mike. And I haven't had that question. And of course, all I can think to draw on this question is my own experience. I don't know of any research on the topic. I have to say yes and no. You know, certainly when my husband was dying, that was very different. The emotions involved mm-hmm. were very, very different from when my mother was dying and my father was dying. I would say if there's a difference, it is most likely an emotional one. You know, the other thing that comes in is your past relationship with the person. So my father and I did not have we had a troubled relationship. And that played a role for better or for worse in the caregiving. So I think it depends. Mm-hmm. To dodge that. I think it totally depends. I think the needs of the family caregiver, period, are overlooked in general. We talk about, you know, the isolation that someone feels when they get a cancer diagnosis, for example. Well, I can tell you firsthand that people check in. Not many, lots of people disappear, but people check in on my loved one who has cancer, because guess what? They're probably going to die of that cancer, and you're going to feel better if you checked in with him before he died. But people rarely think to check in with the family caregiver who is going through something similar but different, right? Isolation is similar, but yeah. I'm going to go on after he dies, and I'm going to live with how I handled the end of his life. I'm going to live without him, you know, all sorts of things. And yet the family caregiver frequently gets forgotten in that situation.
I think that's a great point. And as to your comment about saying it depends, That's the vast majority of the practice of law. So I think it's a perfectly good perfectly good answer to the question, Jen.
Thank you.
As you know, we have an audience of physician executives and those in management positions in medical practices and healthcare systems with us. And so I'm interested in your thoughts on the medical community. Does it fully appreciate the impact of caregiving on individuals rendering the care?
I need some clarification on that.
It occurs that there's, as you say, much focus on the patient or the person with the illness.
Yes.
But I'm wondering if there is maybe not enough attention on the needs of the caregiver, him or herself, by the medical
caregiver.
Community, by the medical community, because
yes.
Certainly it takes a toll, does it not?
Right. No, I think, okay. So there's several ways to look at this and talk about it. And I think it is a big, big missed opportunity that our nurses and physicians and allied health and all of the professional caregivers miss what an incredible asset the family caregiver is. They focus too much. I mean, not too much, of course, you can't focus too much on a patient, but you need to also focus on that family caregiver. If you're in an encounter, I mean, I went to every visit with Bob, you know, every doctor's visit, every infusion. And if you have someone like that in the room, making eye contact with them, finding out who they are in essence a physician extender that you have not tapped into. Because if you're concerned about, you know, sudden weight loss or gain, right? You're listing out some things from this new medication that this patient needs to be aware of and be on the lookout for. I would say you need to pull that caregiver into that same, you know, that same goal setting, because two sets of ears are better than one in terms of these difficult patient encounters. And two, I'm the one who's going to go out and buy the scale, right? I'm the one who's going to make that happen. So that he does weigh himself every day. And, you know, so yes, I think health professional caregivers are missing this completely. I think there's a great opportunity to involve the family caregiver. I also think that there are times when it would not be a bad idea to take the family caregiver aside privately. I mean, I can tell you there were many, many nights when Bob Lemberg, my late husband, who was one of the toughest cookies I know, you know, would be sobbing in the fetal position. And for the better part of the night, and all I could do was, you know, soothe him. And he had a 10 a.m. oncology appointment, and that man would shower and put on a tie and a jacket and walk into that appointment as though he owned the place. And nobody, you know, and talk with his oncologist, like everything was great, was grand. And I am sitting here going, are you kidding me? It's not grand, you know? And so I think it would really help professional caregivers occasionally to make eye contact and kind of do even a private check with the family caregiver. I think when the professional caregiver shows the respect and the understanding of the role of the family caregiver, I think then the patient realizes we're a team here. We're all working toward the same thing. And I think that can help the care in general tremendously.
Well said. As you researched and put together your book, Care Boss, were you surprised by any facts or circumstances that came up during the process of creating the book?
Yeah, yes and no. There's a couple in the... At the front of the book, I talk about what leadership is and what caregiving is. And there were a couple of Harvard Business Review studies that were published about leadership. One of them had, I think it was over 50% of CEOs admitting that they felt lonely and isolated in their job as CEO. And of those 50%, 61% felt that had an adverse impact on their job. And then there was yet another HBR study that showed that 68% of CEOs feel ill-prepared for their work, for their leadership work. And those were, I mean, as a CEO, I felt both of those things. I have felt terribly isolated. I mean, you're not the board and you're not the staff. You're at the most narrow part of the hourglass, and you know, you can work closely with your staff and you can be the best possible team. But at the end of the day, you're the boss. And if anybody has to be let go, you're going to have to let them go. So, you know, you're not friends. You are friends, but you're not that kind of friends. So it's a super lonely position. So I certainly felt that. Of course I felt, I mean, I do a lot of interim leadership, so I'm going in not knowing the people really very well and that sort of thing. So I would feel ill-prepared, but I was a little surprised to learn that many CEOs answering a survey done by the HBR also were admitted to feeling ill-prepared. And those are, you know, they came through to me because they're also very similar to caregiving. No, you know, we feel isolated as caregivers and we feel ill prepared. And so just incredible similarities there.
But it seems to me that caregivers would feel even these things even in a greater
yes
way of being ill prepared, because unlike a CEO in a commercial setting who has trained, he or she's trained for years for that position, we don't really train for caregiving, do we?
No.
So it would seem to me that you could feel all the more ill prepared.
Yes, right. It is. I would say definitely greater for family caregivers in terms of that feeling. But I was surprised that leaders feel that way.
Absolutely. Does caregiving often negatively impact relationship of the caregiver and the person that is receiving care? And if so, what can be done about that?
Yeah, it can certainly. I think it can. I think there's always a caregiver. It's sort of like we always hurt the ones we love kind of thing. Mm. You know, that there were times certainly in all of my caregiving relationships when the person I was caring for, you know, lashed out, said something ugly to me, maybe more than once. It could have really damaged the relationship. And certainly the more that happens, the harder it is. But yeah, in terms of what you can do about it, I mean, to some degree, you have to take that objectivity of leadership that I suggest in the book. You have to kind of get your altitude up and see the bigger picture here and recognize the person feels like, you know, they feel yucky. They feel terrible physically. They are losing control of their lives. They are losing control of, you know, they're not able to do things they used to be able to do. And so they're lashing out and, you know, kind of golden rule type stuff. You know, that you'd probably be feeling the same way and perhaps lashing out also. But the leadership, looking at it through the leadership lens, I think really, really helps. I mean, you can't fire the person, but you can certainly, you know, get that vision and you can get that perspective up in order to sort of remove yourself from too much negative emotion and difficulty.
Jen, your book, Care Boss, is subtitled Leadership Strategies and Resources for Family Caregivers. And we've talked certainly about the leadership aspect. Can you give our audience a preview of the resources your book covers?
Sure. Well, there's several sections to the book. There's strategy and planning. And in that, we look at lots of planning, from everything from having a go bag ready, you know, with all the phone cord and the reading glasses and the teeth or whatever it is that, you know, needs to be in the go bag, and taking that to every, even the random outpatient visits, because so often as someone gets sicker, those outpatient visits can turn into an admission, to keeping a comprehensive medical record of your own, because so many systems do not have medical record systems that speak to each other, to doing a comprehensive end of life plan with the person you're caring for. So that's, and several other resources in that section that I think are hugely practical and helpful. And then there's team and resources is the next section, which helps you kind of look at, you know, lots of caregivers say, I'm a team of one, or kind of roll their eyes when they hear the word team. It's true. It's very, very lonely. And there may be truly cases where there is only one uncompensated care person, caregiver. But you do have professional caregivers. You do you know, there are a team of doctors and nurses involved and other professionals. And it helps, that section kind of helps the caregiver realize who those resources, those human resources really are, and how to turn, let me know if I can do anything to help, into actual help, how to see the family as, you know, more of a group that some can help and some can't, how to delegate, et cetera. The next section is data and analysis. There's some very specific, first of all, the notion of these, objective work, right? Dollars and cents, time, weight, you know, these objective measurements can be actually quite helpful in what is normally a very emotional job, but having some objectivity and very specific ways of or resources in that section about analyzing incidents. There's a really great method, four quadrant method, that was initiated by President Eisenhower in that section about how to look at some, you know, he famously said, I have two types of problems, urgent and important. And from that, he developed this grid of urgency and importance. And it takes you through that grid and how to look at tasks. You know, really very few situations are both urgent and important in caregiving. Someone's having shortness of breath, that is both urgent and important. Someone fell, both urgent and important. But other things can feel urgent, but they aren't really urgent. Getting the end of life plan together, okay? That's important. That's not urgent. I mean, we need to work on it steadily, but there's, you know, it's not in a moment absolutely urgent. A sale on supplies that you really like, a particular type of supply that you really like, or a treat, you know, your favorite bubble tea or whatever it is, and there's a sale, you know, that might be important to you, but you could delegate it out. I mean, it's got an urgency to it, but it's not necessarily super duper important. So what you can do with that is delegate it out to somebody else. Hey, can you stop by Don's Pharmacy and pick up these things? Or could you run by and get me my favorite drink at, you know, the coffee shop or whatever it is? And then there's those things that somehow get built up as both urgent and important and are really neither. That is just someone else's poor planning or procrastination or whatever it is. And those things, we just need to, you know, recognize them for what they are and discard them. So that, I think that's a really, really useful tool that's in the data and analysis section. There's another one, a root cause analysis method that I think really is easy to use. That's why I put it in the book. And it's called the five whys. And you basically ask the question, you know, so you have a suboptimal outcome of some sort. And you ask the question, you know, why did I run the stop sign when I was taking my person to the doctor's appointment and, you know, ended up being late to the doctor's appointment because I got stopped by a cop, right? And you ask the question, why was I late to the doctor's appointment? Well, I got stopped by a cop. Why did you get stopped by a cop? Because, you know, because I was in a hurry. And you just keep asking why about five times, four sometimes, six other times, but about five times, if you ask that question, you will get down to a root cause. You know, I didn't check to see what the roads were going to be like, you know, what the weather was going to be like this morning when I planned what time we were going to leave, kind of thing. And you can often find something to add to your, you know, to your way of doing things that will solve, you know, prevent those problems in the future. So I like that method a lot because it's easy to use and it really does render some results. So that's that. And then the next section is about seeing the home. And I say home depending on, you know, it could be your home that the person is staying, it could be their home, but seeing the home as the facility. So your listeners understand in healthcare, perhaps unlike any other business, any other industry, the facility plays a huge role, right? Elevator isn't working. That's a problem getting the spine surgery patients down from the fourth floor. There's just all sorts of things that happen in the facility. So this section, and of course, stuff like supplies and environmental services, these are all important things in the facility and helping the family caregiver to see that domicile as the actual facility and how important a role that plays, because, right, the facility can, you know, you got stuff around the, you know, a living room floor, just toys or whatever it is, it can cause a fall. That's a huge risk issue to our mission and vision. So that section is meant to do that. And then there's a self-management section, got loads of very practical resources and tools to help you see yourself and manage yourself. And then finally, a section called Realizing the Vision, which is about the transition. And it also has a number of very practical things in it about realizing the transition from life-sustaining family caregiver to end-of-life hospice family caregiver. These are two dramatically different roles with very different you know, sort of focus and so forth. And it requires a huge paradigm shift for the family caregiver, right? I once worried about, did he get enough to eat? Did he get enough sleep? Is he going to be able to go to work? All this sort of stuff. And now, you know, people worried about blood sugar and pulse ox and all these sort of things. Now, when you get into hospice, it's time to focus on precious time. It's time to focus on just being with your person and keeping them comfortable, which may in fact mean not feeding them, you know, as often or as much, or them sleeping more and more. They become less social. These sorts of things that happen, you know, in the end of life stage, and the caregiver really has to make a paradigm shift to go from, you know, what are his vitals, basically, to I just need to be there and be with him or her so that, you know, and make sure the death is as dignified and comfortable and peaceful as it can possibly be.
This is such an important book, and so many of us have had to go down this path. I'm thinking about how useful this would have been to me as a caregiver of a family member. So thank you for taking this project on and being a leader in your own right. My guest has been Jennifer O'Brien. The book is CareBoss, Leadership Strategies and Resources for Family Caregivers. Jen, thanks so much for having been on Sound Practice.
Thank you, Mike. It's been my pleasure.
My thanks to Jennifer O'Brien for her time and good work. Her book, CareBoss, Leadership Strategies and Resources for Family Caregivers, will help many people through difficult times. It is a gift to caregivers drafted by life. My thanks also to the American Association for Physician Leadership for making this podcast possible. Please join me next time on Sound Practice. We release a new episode every other Wednesday. Bada bing, bada boom.
Bada bing, bada boom. You've been listening to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders. Check out the show notes for this episode at soundpractice.com. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear them. Email us at info@soundpractice.com. Subscribe to Sound Practice wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically receive our episodes. And please rate us and comment on the podcast in iTunes and Google Play. Sound Practice is presented and produced by the team at American Association for Physician Leadership. We are the world's premier organization for all aspects of physician leadership in every sector of healthcare. Learn more at physicianleaders.org. Holy cow, Batman and Robin, Red Bull Kapow.